It is well accepted that Jaws is an all-time great film, but its progeny don't rank nearly as high. Two True Freaks is proud to present Is It Jaws, where Paul Spitero and Sean Whalen are joined by an all-star list of guest hosts to review old and new films and place them on the Jaws scale, where they're ranked from Jaws to Jaws 4. Of course, for the purposes of the show, that scale does take some liberties with their actual ratings. Sure, movies that are given the ranking of Jaws are considered classic films with few flaws, if any. A ranking of Jaws 2 indicates that the film is very good and worthy of repeated viewings. A Jaws 3 ranking indicates the film was okay, but that's all. A Jaws 4 means it's ranked as a bad movie. Oh, and if you ever saw Back to the Future Part 2, you know that there's a Jaws 19. That ranking indicates that the movie is so incredibly bad that it's actually fun to watch as a result. So please join Paul and Sean as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
Nothing is real. The Beatles. Yellow Submarine.
Look at all the lovely people. Look at all the lovely people.
Artwork, photography, landscapes painted with Beatles sound.
Picture yourself in a boat on a river with tangerine trees and marmalade skies.
We all live in the Yellow Submarine.
The Yellow Submarine.
Yellow Submarine.
We the forces of good. The Beatles.
Submarine.
The boob.
I must complete my bust. Two novels, finish my blueprints, begin my begin.
Hey, Jeremy, must you always talk in rhyme?
If I spoke prose, you'd all find out. I don't know what I talk about.
He's a real nowhere man, sitting in his nowhere land.
The forces of evil. Robin, the butterfly stompy. Snapping turtle Turks. The apple bonkers. The terrible flying glove. Arch villain, the Blue Meanie.
You could pass for the originals.
Well, we are the originals.
We're Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. We hope you will enjoy the show. Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Sit back and let the evening go.
Hey, look at John, will ya?
What's the matter, John, love? Blue meanies?
Newer and bluer meanies have been sighted within the vicinity of this theatre. There's only one way to go out.
How's that?
Singing!
One, two,
three,
four!
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Yours? I am Paul Spataro, and as per usual, I am here with my good buddy, Mr. Sean Whalen.
It is always a pleasure to be here, my friend.
And it is always a pleasure to have you here. This time around, we are joined by Mr. Logan Gardner.
Hello.
Hey, Logan. How are you?
Doing good.
And in order to get Logan on the show, he insisted that we let his father on with him. So we also have Mr. Scott Gardner.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, I'll be looking for the check. And we are covering today, at Scott's request, actually, Yellow Submarine from 1968. And you know what? Right off the bat, I'm really happy to have Logan in on this one, not only because I like Logan, but because I really like, for something like this with the Beatles, to get a younger person's perspective on it. Because of the four of us, I'm the only one who was alive when this was in the movies. I did not see it in the movies. I saw it. I remember the first time I actually remember seeing it. I don't know if it's the first time I actually saw it, but the first time I remember seeing it was on Labor Day after a Jerry Lewis telethon. They showed it. And for those of you who are young, Jerry Lewis was a comic actor who was in a lot of movies and very, very popular in France, I understand. And later on in his career, he had a regular telethon for muscular dystrophy every Labor Day, which I think went 24 hours or something like that. And he raised a lot of money, and it was always an entertaining show. And then when it ended, Yellow Submarine was on, and I sat and I watched it. And I remember just being enchanted by it at the time. You know, I was at the point where I really loved the Beatles' music. I got a kick out of a lot of the little comedy bits in there. And the animation style, probably a lot of the stylistic things that they were doing in there were lost on me. But I'm not sure that's necessarily a bad thing, having rewatched this morning. But we'll get to that as we talk about it. Sean, when did you first see Yellow Submarine?
For this?
Really?
I've seen bits and pieces of it over the years. I'm a big Beatles fan, and actually, you're really... is valid. Hard Day's Night, Help, many, many times I've seen them. Love both movies. This one, I don't know how I missed it. So it was a really good movie. There's a lot I want to talk about with this one, you know, as far as kind of what my journey was like with it, because I didn't know what to expect. So I walked in not knowing what to expect. And I remember the first half of it saying, wow, this is going to be a review where I'm talking about how much I enjoyed the Beatles' music, but not so much the story. And I really, really have, there's a lot to say about this one as we go forward. So I'll kind of leave it at that.
All right, Scott, do you have any kind of history with this movie?
I all day. Well, actually, since we decided we were going to do this one and picked a date and everything, I have been racking my brains trying to think, when would I have first seen this? And I honestly don't have a memory of it. If I had to guess, it was probably on like Night Flight or something like that, really late at night. It was probably me and my best friend Chris Honeywell watching it together really late at night. I have always associated this film with a late night watch. I think it's just that kind of movie, right up there with like Tron, where it actually lends something into it the later that you watch it. And if you start to maybe doze a little bit during it, it actually just strangely enhances the experience somehow. It's really weird. But yeah, that would be my guess. So I know I saw it, you know, as a relative young, you know, probably in my teens or what. But it wasn't until the advent of video, you know, videotape and video sales. You know, I worked a lot of both in their infancy. I remember when I worked at, like, say, Saturday Matinee, which was a video sales place, this was on heavy rotation on the monitors that we had in the store because it's completely family friendly. You know, there's nothing offensive in it. There's no harsh language. There's no violence, anything like that. It's just, it's one of those, you know, films that you can feel safe to put on and nobody's going to complain or be offended or anything. Not that that was really a big thing back in the 80s and 90s anyway, but you know what I mean? But
sure.
But I mean, I've always been a Beatles fan, but not to the level of friends and family, you know, in my family. So this to me is like the one aspect of the Beatles where I feel like kind of an expert, only because I've watched this movie so many times. I practically have it memorized. But yeah, that's pretty much my history with it.
So Logan, I'm going to start off by asking you, instead of just asking you about your familiarity with the movie, I want to start off by asking you about your familiarity with the Beatles.
The Beatles, I'd say I was probably introduced to them growing up with this movie, you know, because you, Dad, you would put this on as a kid, and it would be something that, to me as a kid, was like the Cocomelon of today's kids. It's just pretty pictures and bright colors and nice music and all that. So then it expanded as I grew up, wanting to venture into, all right, what is this band all about? And listening to that kind of music.
Is that your type of music? Because, you know, when I talk to people in their 20s, you know, some of them, you know, hip hop is their thing. Some people, you know, this K-pop is now, I think that's more with girls than boys, but it's still a big thing. You know, there's a lot of different genres of music out there. I mean, are you a classic rock fan, or, you know, where do you fall music wise?
I'd say it kind of depends, but for the most part, yeah, I'd say like 60s to 80s, like rock, or I guess now classic rock kind of music, you know, Beatles, Elton John, you know, music kind of like that.
That's so good.
it's kind of what I grew up with. You know, I just recently at work, you know, most of the music that we play is like older, like 60s to 80s music. And I had people comment saying like, oh, he doesn't know all the words to this song. Meanwhile, yes, I absolutely do.
Cool.
I hate that assumption so much.
Well, that's I didn't want to assume. That's why I wanted to ask you what your background was on it. And, you know, so we have your background on the music and your background on this movie. This was the, I need some quiet time, so I'm putting this on so that my kids can watch it and get engrossed in the movie. I had several of those for my kids when this was not one of them. But, you know, this was made, the way I understand it, is the Beatles did A Hard Day's Night, which we have reviewed on this program and got excellent reviews. They did Help, which has not been reviewed on this show, which may at some point be done. They did Magical Mystery Tour, which we have not done on the show, but quite frankly, I consider to be, other than the music, which I love, the actual movie is kind of an abomination.
Oh, yes.
It's a horrible, horrible movie as far as I'm concerned. But that wasn't part of their contract. Their contract was with United Artists for a three-picture deal. They did A Hard Day's Night. They did Help. And apparently, at least the way I've understand it, they didn't like the way Help was finally came out, which I find Help to be a very amusing movie. Again, maybe we'll cover that at some point. But they, at this point in their careers in 1968, when this was done, you know, may have started in 67, I don't even know. But when this was done, they really didn't want to deal with this movie anymore. They weren't happy with the last one. So they kind of begged off as much as they could. And that's why there's other voice actors doing their parts. They did the music, obviously, a lot of which predated this movie anyway. A lot of the music was just songs that they had already. There's not a lot of music that came out original in this movie. I think only A Northern Song and Hey Bulldog are two, but I'm not sure about anything else.
Yeah, I used to know that, and I've since forgotten. But yeah, I because this, when I was first starting out, this was one of the first Beatle albums I ever got, because full confession, Yellow Submarine's my favorite song. Which led to my wanting to watch the movie in the first place. But yeah, you're right. There's only just a couple songs on the actual album, you know, the original album, that hadn't been released prior on some other Beatle album.
So the scene at the end when they do All Together Now, they did that solely out of contractual obligation that they actually appear in the film. That's the only reason that little tag is on at the end of it. And even that, according to what I read on it, they were going to do some sort of psychedelic background for it and all. And then they just said, yeah, just leave the black background. so they really, you know, kind of cheaped out on it. But I remember when I was watching this, my oldest brother and my sister were talking about it. And they were talking about how they saw it in the movies. And particularly when they sang All You Need Is Love, they said everybody in the audience was singing along with it. So, you know, it's kind of, you know, it would have been a kind of a cool experience to have seen it that way. When I look at it now, I see the animation, and I think I want to talk about the animation first. And I see a lot of psychedelic images. I see a lot of images that are, you know, the pop art of the day and playing on that to a great extent. And I think there's a lot of things in the artwork that I didn't get when I was a kid, and I'm not sure I still get it even now.
Right.
I could say the same thing, yeah.
You know, it's so a little bit of that is lost on me, and I think this becomes a movie that, like, I've described it as just, you know, we talk about comfort food movies. This is a movie I could put on and I don't really have to pay attention. If I have something else to do, if I'm doing some work around the house, if I have some chores to do, this is a movie I could put on, and every once in a while I can glance at the TV set and watch it, and then I can just keep it going, and I listen to the soundtrack, and I'm cool with it. Because yeah. I don't really need the animation, frankly.
Right. Well, this in a lot of ways, I think this is... It's kind of like a music video before music videos, if you know what I mean. Because it's like a feature length music video in a lot of ways. It's also, to me, I think it's sort of like a new age, you know, for the 60s, you know, the late 60s. It's kind of like a new age Fantasia in that way, that it's taking I see Sean's. Yeah, Sean's liking this comment. But you know what I mean? It's taking those Beatles songs, it's wrapping a narrative around them and everything, because it does clearly tell a story.
But, a weird one, but yes.
Yeah, it is very weird, but there is, you know, there is actually a narrative, there is actually a story, but again, I think, you know, as you said, this is one of those that you could put it in the background and not necessarily pay attention to it and still thoroughly enjoy it because of the music. And, you know, all of that. And again, that lends into what I was saying earlier about this being like the perfect late night movie that if you kind of doze in and out a little bit, it works. You know, it still works with this type of movie.
Well, I would imagine, I'm sorry, Sean, I'll get you in a second. I would imagine when they made this, they had the thought that you'd be having some sort of mind altering substances in you while you were watching it. Sean, you had a point?
So, it was funny. Scott's like nailing, I think, what made the movie work for me. So the first time through watching it, my first half of it, I didn't like it. And I want to be clear, loved the Beatles music. But I'm sitting here, this is coming off of Hard Day's Night and Help. I was expecting more of that. So watching this through, I was kind of like, this is not what I'm expecting at all. And sometimes when you get hit with that, you're having trouble understanding like the movie. I mean, as far as right. like getting into the vibe and getting into the whole piece, your reference to music video, to Fantasia in particular, halfway through my first viewing, I started realizing, wait a minute, this is Fantasia. And I don't say that to cookie cutter it. It's artsy. It's an exploration. The animators were trying to do something. You know, they're trying to connect songs that weren't intended to be initially, some of them were, but some of the songs were not intended to be part of a story like this. Right. And they found clever ways to do that. And it gets very heady, gets very psychedelic. I loved the animation partway through. It's Monty Python type animation too. You know, I was connecting with that piece to it. So my second viewing, I kind of like had gotten past all that and went through and just enjoyed this film for what it is and the fact that it's a unique art piece. And I found it's for somebody who's listening to this that has not seen this before, do not go in expecting Hard Day's Night and Help. It's not that.
No.
But when you do, to Scott's point, you start looking at this as Fantasia and they're doing a music video piece and you start looking these as interconnected vignettes. The movie works a lot better like that. And I found a lot to enjoy in this crazy story that they were delivering for us along the way about blue people hating music, which was.
So is this, what you call it? Is this Footloose? Is this, you know, the town didn't want music and Kevin Bacon had to come and save the town from all the music hating people? I'm trying to think of what is the message in this movie. And that's what I'm thinking it is. It's the, at least as best as I can do it. And, you know, it's up to everybody to interpret, is that the, you know, Pepperland is the free spirited hippies of the world, you know, because we're talking 1968, and the Blue Meanies are society trying to shut them down. That's the way I interpret it.
That's definitely one way you could look at it. I always looked at it more of, you know, I'm trying to remember how it's described. An unearthly paradise, because there's the narrator that comes in at the beginning and says, you know, that there was an unearthly paradise called Pepperland. And Pepperland to me was just always like, it was almost like a utopian society where, you know, peace and harmony ruled and, you know, music was the order of the day and people were just happy and everything. And the Meanies, for whatever reason, hated that. They hated music and they hated the people of, you know, of Pepperland and wanted to shut the whole thing down. I guess that goes along with what you were saying as well, but to me, ultimately, the message of the movie, and this is going to sound very simple and corny, but the message of the movie to me is love conquers all. Because the thing that I think really warms my heart more than anything in this movie is that it's not just the Beatles coming to defeat the Blue Meanies and drive them out of Pepperland and restore Pepperland. As soon as they do that, what's the first thing they do? Will you come join us? You know, they're calling to the Blue Meanies. Hey, blue people, come join. And so they're not hateful of them. They're not resentful or spiteful for anything that's happened. They bring them into the fold and welcome them in and make them happy people. I think that's great. I think that's a wonderful message. And that's one of the reasons I think this is a good movie for kids, you know, because despite everything that the Blue Meanies have done, they weren't hated and despised. They were welcome if they were, you know, able to get over whatever their issue was with the Pepperlanders and come in and join them. And at the end of the movie, everybody's together and enjoying the music. And I think that's wonderful. I think it's a great message.
Yeah, and I mean, I do think there's an overlap there. I mean, you seeing anything different in the slogan?
No, I think it's the same sort of thing of, it's also probably around that same time there was, you know, war and everything going on, but instead of showing them fighting back with weapons, they're fighting back with peace and love, which is,
and apples,
you know, kind of what the Beatles were about. They were hippies, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, the apple symbology is really easy because they had just started Apple Records, I think, a year before this movie was made. So, you know, that's pretty easy to pick up, that those are the weapons that are being used. Like I said, you know, the animation, well, I mean, kind of combining the animation with the story a little bit, as they're going from place to place, I saw two spots that I thought, you know, were a little bit of geek heaven that they just gave you. When they come through and there's all of a sudden like the Phantom and these other like old car comic characters.
I could be wrong, but I think those were all King's Feature Syndicate characters.
I think so.
In that scene, and I think they had something to do with either the animation in the movie, or they may have been the first company that was licensed to produce like a comic adaptation or something. So there's some licensing thing there. There's a reason why that's in the movie. I've since forgotten exactly what it is, but yeah.
See, I could be totally wrong on this, but I kind of took it from the point of view of, from a licensing point of view, these are characters they were able to use and they wanted to.
Right.
As opposed to somebody like saying, hey, put in these because we own them.
Right.
But the other thing is the King Kong moment, which is another geek out moment in there, and just makes me laugh every time I see it.
Well, John's the Frankenstein monster until he takes the formula too. Yeah,
That's right. I forgot that too. Yeah. I mean, it's just some like, moments.
Banner on the back of the submarine during that one bit where the Rolling Stones kind of came out.
Well, yeah. Yeah.
Well, this, I mean, there's a, again, there's a lot of symbols
right.
in the animation, a lot of which go by so fast that unless you're going to break it down, you can start pausing and freeze framing. You probably miss, and I guarantee you I miss. And I probably do see something new in this every time I've watched it because absolutely. There is so much that's going by on the screen. So I'll give the animation credit for that. A lot of the animation is very basic feeling, but I think that's intentional as well. I think that's to create kind of a far out feeling and the pop art feeling of the day. So it's certainly not for a lack of effort that it looks less polished. I think it's actual effort that made it look less polished. I think that was their intention.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's one of the things that struck me on this most recent rewatch. It had been a couple of years since I'd seen this. And correct me if I'm wrong, Logan, you might remember this. So this, I have all my life, because this movie came out, when it came out, I was like 2 or 3 months old, literally, because I was born in 68. The movie was released in 68. So I'd always wanted to see it on the big screen. And it did come back to theaters for one of its anniversaries. I forget which one. But did we actually make it to the movies for? I know we wanted to go, but did we actually go?
For this one?
Yeah.
I don't believe so.
I don't think we did. I think we missed it. I think it never played in our area was the thing. We wanted to go see it on the big screen, and it just never came to this area. So, you know, watching it here at the house in my home theater, that's the first time I've ever seen it large, you know, like on a, you know, huge screen. And as I was prepping to watch it, I was bracing myself for, I always remember this as being animation akin to like the 60s Marvel superhero show. And it's not that. It's just in my memory, it was like a very, almost like Saturday morning cartoon, like very unsophisticated, not particularly good. And that's totally not, it's just very stylized. It has a very distinct style to it and everything that seems overly simplistic, but they pull off some effects that when you stop and think, hey, this was before computers, are pretty impressive. There's a 360 shot of the Yellow Submarine when it pops in from, I think it's when they are in the Sea of Holes, I think. Yes. Mm-hmm. It gets swallowed. Or no, it's the Sea of Monsters. It gets swallowed by the suction cup or the suction mm-hmm. beast.
Yeah.
And it pops back into existence and it does a 360 spin. And that 360 spin looks computer generated, but it can't be because that technology didn't exist. That's impressive animation. It's really impressive.
That happens to be one of my favorite sequences in the movie, frankly, because as the suction monster is sucking everything in, I remember as a kid thinking, oh, I wonder if he's going to suck in everything. And then he sucks in the background and then he sucks in himself. Which right. it was like a fantasy moment, and they did what I wanted them to do,
right?
And I just thought it was, you know, really, really cool. And I, again, to this day, I still enjoy that whole sequence very much. Going from the art to the voice actors, I guess you start off with the narrator, who I think, you know, he had a good voice. I don't really know him to speak of. I am more caught by just the dialogue they give him, you know, once upon a time, or maybe twice. You know, it feels very Monty Python-esque when he's doing the narration.
I like the line, 80,000 leagues beneath the sea it lay or lie. I'm not quite sure. I love that.
Yeah.
It's like something I would write, you know. But I just love the thought of it being 80,000 leagues beneath the sea. Well, that's 8 times the circumference of the Earth. So it's not that deep. it's nonsense numbers, but I love it. You know, and if you don't stop to think about it, it's just, you know, they're just throwing numbers out there.
4 times more than Captain Nemo went.
Right, right.
I had thought for years and years that this was the Beatles doing their own voices.
Me too.
Yeah. I think they got excellent voice actors to do their voices, because I didn't realize until I read that there were actual other voice actors. And I read that George Harrison's voice actor did part of the movie, but then had some sort of problems in his life and had to be replaced by somebody else. And that's pretty seamless because I never noticed a change.
Right. What's funny for me is that because this is the Beatles thing that I'm most familiar with, you know, just through repetition and hearing it so many times, you know, when I worked in video, that this is the Beatles' voices to me. So when I hear the actual Beatles, they actually sound a little funny to me. So like when you get to like the end of the movie, when it actually is the Beatles, the real Beatles, they sound a little off to me. And that to me is just, that's funny, you know? These guys did a great job, don't get me wrong, but it's just I'm so much more accustomed to their voices than the actual Beatles voices. It's funny.
So I'm going to ask you guys, I'm sorry, go ahead, Sean.
I really appreciated the fact that they were able to be themselves in alternate versions of themselves. Like that whole sequence, right, where they were doing that. Because, you know, I mentioned before, A Hard Day's Night and Help, I really liked the Beatles mannerisms in that. Not only did they capture that, but they captured that on two levels, because the interactions between John and John and Paul and Paul and Ringo and Ringo, I mean, they kept doing that, and it was subtle in the background sometimes and in the foreground of the animation. And I thought they did a great job. That's hard. It's hard enough to be the person when you're trying to mimic them, but then to mimic them a second time for the purpose of the whole timey-wimey time travel thing that they were doing in this, that I really enjoyed. I thought that was a success, and I more impressive when you take a look at the fact that it actually wasn't them.
Right.
Yeah.
This might be a good time to mention, did you know, Paul, there's actually two versions of this movie. There's actually the original European version, and then there was an American version. Now, the American version is what I grew up watching, and that's what was on videotape for the longest time. I'm not sure when the European version became the standard version. I think when it hit Blu-ray, I think. I'm not sure. But the differences are when the Beatles release Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, and when they dissolve the bubble that's holding them, in the American version, they never interact with them. So there is no duplication of, you know, so like John and John talking to each other and stuff like that. It cuts to another scene, but eventually it goes straight to where Paul says, and I've always liked the American version just a little bit better because the way Paul delivers the line, Beatles the battle, it's more of a war cry. And I really like that. So it cuts out their interaction with their duplicates, but it also cuts out the entire Hey Bulldog sequence as well. So it's actually just a little bit shorter, and there's a little bit different music in that sequence that I think comes from a different source. It doesn't sound like George Martin's score to me. It's really kind of odd. So when Logan and I watched the film, we watched the European version, but then I put the American one on just to watch that one sequence so that we could see the difference between the two of them. I think he likes the Hey Bulldog sequence a lot better, but not having grown up with that version, it always seems a little off to me. So it's just funny. You know, you're used to what you're used to kind of thing.
Just, I didn't realize there were two different versions, and I'm curious as to why there would have been, but
they apparently cut most of that, like Hey Bulldog and like parts around it, they cut out for time, which I found funny because the movie itself isn't that long.
No, it's, what does it have it listed as? 89 minutes. So, I mean, to me, for a theatrical release, and, you know, we were talking earlier about some Disney movies and all of that, there are exceptions to this rule, but for a theatrical release meant for adults, because this was meant for adults, let's,
right,
you know, I mean, it's meant to be entertaining for children, but this is not meant to be just a children's movie. I always felt like 90 minutes was the cutoff. Like you really needed to do 90 minutes where it felt like you were chipping us a little bit. But that's, you know, so I don't know why you'd cut it. I mean, I understand when they cut stuff off for time to add commercials on TV. I don't understand why they cut things for theatrical releases for time like that, unless you have a movie that's, you know, 3.5 hours long and they're trying to get more viewings in a given day. What I wanted to do was I wanted to go over some of the characters and just discuss your thoughts about the character and your thoughts about the voice actor, rather than kind of jump into both, you know, jump back and forth. So the first character of note to me is old Fred, or young Fred, depending on who's talking to him. What did you think?
You want me to go?
Yeah, I'm gonna gather my thought.
I love him. I think he's very lovable. He's very likable. I love his voice. I love that he's very reluctant to the whole thing. But when he gets, you know, the on the spot promotion, he's like, "Oh, well, in that account, yes." You know, he agrees to it right away. But yeah, there's something very sweet about him. He's got that sort of like absent-minded professor quality to him that I really like. But he's charming. He's just a sweet, charming character. I really like him. This is one of those movies I find myself quoting a lot. And Fred has one of my favorite lines when they finally get to Pepperland and he finds the Lord Mayor and he goes, "Lord Mayor," he goes, "he's been bunked." He goes, "Lord Mayor, unbunk yourself." I say that a lot. Unbunk yourself. So I love that line.
I also like that he wouldn't give up. You know, it was like, yeah, the land was being destroyed around him. And there was a great animation bit where, you know, he was like the one holding on.
Right.
You know, so he, to the point of his changing journey along the way, you got to see him in this great moment where it was, I think others would give up, and he kept trying to hold on, kept trying to persevere. And it led to some funny bits, but that was one of the things with the humor in this that I thought they did real well. They interjected quite a bit of humor into this, but didn't go too far. And that was an example of a sequence where there was humor in how he was able to keep surviving, but they never took it to that like over the top edge where it took away from the sense of danger that he was in that moment, while keeping it to the point of what was said earlier. This is a very family friendly film. I don't know that it was intended that way, but I actually like, there's a sweet nature to the whole thing. And it, I guess that's the piece that never got lost even in that sequence. And it really worked. So I liked the character a great deal more as the film went on with him than even initially.
Right.
See, I would beg to differ just to the extent that I kind of found him endearing right from the start.
Yeah.
I didn't feel he had to grow on me at all. I got a kick out of him. And especially as a very young viewer when I saw this, or a relatively young viewer, I felt that tension with him being chased and all of that. And I thought it was well done. I thought I thought both the character as written, as animated, and as voiced were all very good.
Yeah, absolutely. I love when he's at the door of, I'm not sure what it's supposed to be, some sort of a mansion or something, but when he's begging for help and he starts going through the letters of the word help. I love E is for urgent, always cracks me up. I absolutely love that because no, it's not, but that's I just love that. You know, and when he finally, you know, he's basically on his knees begging, he's going, "Won't you please, please help me?" And it's like, that's from the song Help. I love it. It's lyrics. There's a lot of lyrics in this movie, and you kind of have to listen for them, but they did that a lot, and I love it.
Anything to add, Logan?
I always found him, like, charming and endearing as the first, well, almost the first character that you get to see before the group comes together, and he acts as kind of the person that gets the band together in the first place.
Right.
But weirdly enough, like as the movie goes on, and even though we just watched it like a week or so ago, he's the character I kind of remember the least personally. Because once you have everyone together, you know, obviously the focus kind of shifts towards them.
Now, the character that had very little screen time but made an impression on me was the Lord Mayor. First of all, I always get a kick out of him calling him Young Fred.
Right.
Second of all, the one part that did stay with me was, we're going to complete our quartet, trio, duet, solo. And I just got a big kick out of that.
I love the way he delivers the line when he finally realizes the threat after it's gone down to Solo, and he goes, the Blue Meanies are coming. Just the way, you know, the old man way he says, I love it. I love it. He's a great character too.
Any thoughts on the Chief Blue Meanie? Because I always thought there was something about him, some sort of undercurrent that I wasn't quite understanding. The way, like, when he talks, Glove, hey, Glove, come here. Like, just the way he speaks, I thought there's something where he's imitating somebody or he's making fun of somebody, or there's something there that I never quite understood. But I, you know, maybe there's more to it. But, I mean, I always got a kick out of him. He felt menacing enough. But I just thought there was something I was missing.
I don't know about him imitating somebody, but I tell you who does imitate him is Mark Hamill when he does the Joker. Mark Hamill lifted a lot of his Joker from the Head Blue Meanie, which I love. If you, especially you watch the sequence in Batman Mask of the Phantasm when the Joker comes to the hospital to menace, oh gosh, I forgot the guy's name. The guy that he gives the Joker venom to. That entire sequence could be the Chief Blue Meanie. It's lifted right from this movie. And I love his performance in that. Because he's got that same weird yet menacing quality to him. And it really works. It's cool. But yeah, I love his character too. This is one of those, you know, you were talking about when you watch it, you know, you pick up new things and, you know, in the details and in the visuals every time you watch it. I pick up new things in the audio every time I watch. There's some line that I missed in the past or some gag that went over my head before when I saw it. And every time I watch it, I pick up something new. And a lot of it is in his dialogue and his interactions with Max.
How about Jeremy the Boob? Any thoughts?
I always love Jeremy. I feel like your opinion on him is kind of 50-50. Like, most people either really despise him or most people find him really endearing. And I'm on the side of finding him kind of endearing.
See, I looked at Jeremy, and I got to be careful because I don't want to say this in a way that's going to insult anybody. But when I watched it most recently, I thought Jeremy has some sort of a, like an OCD quality to him that I never realized when I was younger. You know, when he just can't help but have to go off on these tangents and describe everything that he's seeing and, you know, do rhymes and do words. And like, I found him, like when I started to look at him that way, I found him to be, besides endearing, a little bit more sympathetic.
Yeah.
You know, especially when they're singing Nowhere Man, I'm like, stop making fun of him. You know, it was weird. But I've grown to like that character more, I think, every time I've watched the movie.
Yeah. I remember as a kid, one of the people I'd watch this with quite often was, my Uncle Randy. Now, Randy is, biologically, he's my uncle, but we're actually the same age. So we kind of grew up very much like brothers. He's a huge Beatle fan, much more than I am. And he informed a lot of my love of the Beatles and everything and brought me into a lot of things with the Beatles because he had all the albums and that sort of thing. And I remember watching this with him, and he could never stand Jeremy. I don't know how he feels about him today. But somehow his disdain for him at the time rubbed off on me as well. So it's taken me a long time to warm to that character. But now I do genuinely love him. I think he's a wonderful character. But you know, sometimes you kind of have to warm to different characters. And yeah, he was kind of a slow warm for me. But I really have come to enjoy him. I like his dynamic with Ringo a lot. When they do the whole Nowhere Man song and then the song ends and they're like, okay, let's go. And they're just going to leave him behind. I love that it's Ringo that feels bad for him. He's like, oh, poor little fella. And he wants to bring him along. I love that. And that really warmed me to both of those characters that much more.
I like that he had an arc that he seemed to improve as a character the more he was with them, too.
Right.
Like, yeah. Which I thought was something that was interesting, because they start delivering this message along the way. And I think it's one of the victories of the film is you've got this story that's interconnecting these songs, and you're trying to send this message of peace and, you know, just the importance of peace. And along the way, you can see how, like, Jeremy almost seems to be, as he's starting to believe a little bit more into what they're doing, like, he's getting on board. And I kind of enjoyed that piece. And the Ringo piece where he and Ringo connected, like, even when Ringo rescued him at the one point in time where he was, like, hanging upside down. And I loved the whole bit because they seem to become buddies. And
right.
I really enjoyed, like, even like when he's high-fiving him on his sort of karate victory. I really enjoyed that bit. He's out. He's got the manual out there talking through how he's going to handle this karate move. And it had nothing to do with the manual, but then Ringo's still giving him, like, a, you know, high five for what he did. I thought it was a great humorous animation bit, and actually added to my enjoyment of the character, because I do think he's a slow build. Cause in the beginning, I'm kind of like, I don't know if I like him or if I'm annoyed by him or what my deal is with him. It was he by that sequence, I was all in on Jeremy, and I don't feel that it was like that through the entire journey for me with him.
Right. Well, I mean, he's a very odd looking character, but then it's also, you know, with the rhymes and just his whole delivery when you first meet him, he can be very off putting, I feel. It takes, like, getting to kind of know him. And I think, like you said, you know, when he starts, you know, when he goes with them and hanging out with them and being part of their mission, and especially his friendship with Ringo, I think that helps give him the focus that he lacked in his life. And it starts to make him more of a character.
Yeah, no, I agree. Go ahead, Logan.
I love, whether it's just the art style itself, or, like, intentional or not, he kind of resembles the Meanies a little bit. Not necessarily in color, but design a little bit. You know, the circular shape and the fluffy-looking body. So it's kind of, yeah. Paul's showing a picture of it. But yeah, it's kind of like he's almost a half-and-half mixture, you know, appearance-wise, of the Meanies, but also the Beatles with the brownish and bit of color.
That's a really good observation.
I hadn't thought of that, but that is true. Like, he's somewhere in between them, and he's like kind of bridging the gap a little bit. And now, next time I watch this, I'm going to have to see if the story kind of carries a little bit of that theme in it, which I hadn't ever considered before. So, good, very good call. Now, I had this album since the 1970s, and I always listened to the songs. I never really listened to the score.
Right.
I listened to the score as I was watching it, and it's a lot of heavy instrumentation, a lot of orchestration. It feels almost like mostly what I'm getting from it is kind of an adventure theme, but kind of a fantasy adventure theme, like not a heavy duty adventure. And that's the feel I'm getting from it. And with all the music in here, with all of the songs that are in here, the score tends to just, even though it's constantly there, it kind of gets overshadowed by the songs. So I think even though it's really very obvious when you're listening for it, it's still kind of subtle because the music is so overpowering throughout it. I'm wondering any thoughts you have beyond that.
I love the score to this. It's funny what you say about, you know, because the original album, that's how it was produced, is you had all of the Beatles songs on one side, on the A side of the album. And then the B side was an abbreviated version of the score of the film. And I can remember Randy playing the A side on heavy rotation and never, ever, ever playing the B side at all, because that just wasn't his style of music or anything. This was one of those scores that I always wanted them to do a more full and expanded version of. I'm not sure if they ever did, but somewhere or other in my collection, I got my hands on the complete score. I don't know where the source is of that. I don't know if it was a bootleg or if it was an official source. It just, I had it so long, I don't even remember where I acquired it. But I will profess, I don't know anything about George Martin. The only other thing in my collection by him is he did the score to one of the Bond films. I'm not seeing it in my Apple Music at the moment, so I don't remember which one it was. Live and Let Die, maybe? I forget, but that's the only other thing I know of from him. But I love this score. I think it has a quality to it where it sounds deceptively simple, but it's actually pretty complex. It incorporates a lot of classical music. It does a really good job, especially in the very beginning of the film, of going from peaceful, tranquil, utopian Pepperland to menace. As young Fred or old Fred is with the mayor, and the meanies are encroaching on them and about to overrun them, listen to the music in that sequence. It's great. It's very menacing, and it adds to the tension of that scene of, you know, what's happening. And I really enjoy that. And he does a really nice rendition of Yellow Submarine as an instrumental when the sub comes to Pepperland. You know, after Fred and the submarine get separated, and you know, we're at the temple, and the Yellow Submarine comes out of the sky. I love that. It's a great scene, and the music is very, you know, it's a hurrah moment. I like that. But I think it's a wonderful score, and this is one of those albums, one of those scores that is really good. Like if you're trying to fall asleep, like you're having trouble sleeping or whatever, you want to just read and have, you know, just some nice music to listen to as you're trying to nod off. It makes a great score for that, which may sound like an insult, but there's not a lot of movie scores, especially, you know, of action or anything like that, where it's melodic enough that you can fall asleep to it, you know, but this is, you know, works well in that regard. But yeah, I think it's a great score. It's one of the things
just,
I like.
Just as a, just as a follow-up, yeah, he scored Live and Let Die, which makes total sense since Paul McCartney did the theme song.
Yeah.
And if you listen to the Live and Let Die score, which I have, it's constantly replaying that Live and Let Die song and playing it in a James Bond theme kind of way. So I happen to love that particular score.
That's cool.
I think one of the challenges the score had in this too is, so you've got a movie where your goal is to be getting you from one great Beatles song to the next, right? And right, obviously to then highlight and spotlight the newer music that is going to be a part of this film. The score doesn't get in the way. And I don't say right, that as an insult either. I haven't listened to it in isolation like you have. Actually, Scott, you got me incredibly interested in listening to it in isolation because I don't have the passion for it that you do, but I haven't listened to it that way. And I'm kind of anxious to now because I listen to scores when I read a lot of times, particularly comics. I like having something playing in the background. I could see this, right, that's where this score would work. But the challenge is you've got this adventure journey that we're going on, and the goal of each intermission or each in between sequence, I should say, leading you to the next video, the next song, is to keep the story going and to keep you going on this journey without feeling like jarring. Right. They managed to come up with a score that didn't make me feel like, all right, now we're out of Beatles music and we're back into Beatles music. Right. Out of Beatles music, back into Beatles music. And I never felt that during the film, which I think is a victory of the score. Because if you feel that part of it, then the score has completely failed in its goal to keep this thing cohesive all the way along. And it didn't do that. It did a very good job of keeping me feeling like I'm going along, which that's a good trick.
Well, something that occurs to me is that I hadn't thought about this before, but something you just said really struck a chord with me is that you know, Martin could have very easily made this less work for himself by just simply doing like the John Barry method. So like when John Barry would compose Bond scores, quite often, whatever the lead song of the movie was, became the theme and the motif throughout the score. And he doesn't, you know, George Martin doesn't do that with this movie. Off the top of my head, the only Beatles song that's referenced in his score is Yellow Submarine. And it's done as kind of a triumphant, like a almost like a hero march type of thing. So he could have gone the route of, you know, his orchestration could have been leading you into the next Beatles song or bringing you out of the Beatles song that just played through the through his instrumental score, but he doesn't do that, and I think that's pretty cool. I think that it's interesting and very cool that it is an all original score that's not just relying on whatever Beatles song is either just played or coming up to be played. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely makes sense. I have two thoughts. Just one is just that I keep thinking more about, and I am so inexpert or not expert on music. I just know what I like. But thinking about this score as we're talking about it, and I mentioned about that it has more of a fantasy element than an action adventure, even though the story kind of has action adventure. But now I'm thinking about the score and I'm running through it in my head. I think, unless I'm missing something, he did most of the scoring with strings and not horns. And I think for most action adventure movies, they use a lot more horns. Right. So I think that's what gives it that fantasy feel, to try and bring it a little more into, like, just break it down. But your thought about it not mirroring the Beatles songs is interesting to me, because I'm just mentioning 2 minutes ago that I love the way Live and Let Die kind of takes that song and turns it into a Bond theme through the whole movie. So I don't see that as the lazy way out necessarily, because right. I think that's a wonderful score. But this, I got to say, not only did he make more work for himself, but what a gutsy move. that you're saying, you know what, this is a Beatles movie, but I'm going to make my own music in here. I just think that's amazing.
Yeah. I find this very much akin to like an old Warner Brothers cartoon score, the way that Carl Stalling had such an encyclopedic knowledge of classical music that he could weave, you know, dozens of different classical music pieces, you know, just little snippets of them through, you know, a 7 or 8 minute cartoon and, you know, pepper them in. And I find that through this entire score, George Martin has done a very similar thing. There's so many references to classical pieces. Many of them are really short, but he pieces that together really nicely. And it does, again, add a very dreamlike quality to the music, and also just the way the thing is scored, where it has that feeling like you're in a massive hall listening to this music. You know, it has that echo effect to it, adds to it as well. It really works well for me in the scene of the Sea of Monsters and the Sea of Holes, that echo effect, like you're in a huge space with that music in the background. That works really well.
I was going to say it the same way for the music, is that it's very dreamlike for the score.
Mm-hmm.
And coincidentally, because of the title of the movie, is that most of the time the music itself feels kind of like floaty. And
yes.
Yeah.
You know, it just flows right along. It's very smooth. It never feels too harsh unless it needs to be.
Melodic.
Yes, yeah. Very melodic and just sails you right through.
I think that's kind of what I was saying with the fantasy aspect of it, that it has this fantasy feel, that it's not bringing you into, ooh, let's have, you know, we're going into, to, you know, the Sea of Holes, let's have some scary music. We're in a dream world. I definitely get that feel from it.
I'd be very curious to know, like, how much thought he put into the song that was leading into a sequence and the song afterwards versus the actual events that he was scoring that would have been beyond the screen. Because to your point about it being melodic and how it kind of flows, I'm more curious than I've been probably in a long time on a scoring sequence because of the fact that you're coming out of Beatles songs, but yet you have to be cognizant of what is going on the screen, how much thought he put into that or where his focus was. Did he prioritize the action on the screen, or was he thinking actively about what it's coming from and where it's going when he was doing this? Because it's a unique challenge, I think, in this piece.
Absolutely.
And you referenced Fantasia earlier, where Fantasia's kind of doesn't have that. Fantasia right. is deliberately sequences where the music is being animated. There's not this in-between sequence where I was just thinking when we were mentioning this piece before, I'm like, that's where this is unique. That particular vehicle didn't have these in-between sequences leading right. from one song to another. So it's I want to read up more and learn like a little bit more about what went on behind the scenes with his particular scoring of this film.
I've often wondered, and I need to put in some homework on this to find out, but I've often wondered if there's any sort of making of resource for this movie out there. Like, did they write a book? Is it part of a larger book that might be out there about the Beatles or about the Beatles films or anything like that? I don't know. I would love to find something, you know, a movie or a documentary or something in writing or whatever of Martin talking about the scoring process for this. Oh, what do you got there, Paul?
You know, I haven't looked at this in years. This, my daughter gave me this for Christmas one time, and it's a book of Yellow Submarine. It's actually just the story in a book form.
Right.
I thought it might have some making of moments in it, so I wanted to grab it while we were talking, but no. Oh, well.
Have you
read
that before?
I'm sorry?
Have you read through that before?
No, I just kind of like the cover. I put it on display in my cabinet with my Yellow Submarine Beatles figures. And I actually have the ceramic Yellow Submarine with the guys on it. I have one shelf that has that.
I was going to ask if it almost plays like a children's book, how it's narrated through the story in that way. Because I do feel like this movie would make for a good, like, children's bedtime story.
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely. It definitely reads like a children's book. This would be clearly a very good book to read, like, as a you know, a good night book for a young kid. So, you know, but, you know, my kids just know I love the Beatles, so don't mind me anything they say.
In 2002, Dr. Bob Hieronymus made a book. It's a two-volume book series called Inside the Yellow Submarine, The Making of the Beatles Animated Classic.
Oh, all right.
So I was just looking while we were chatting here just to see if there anything out there. And they're available. So it's Dr. Bob Hieronymus, and it's Inside the Yellow Submarine, The Making of the Beatles Animated Classic.
I'm going to have to seek that out.
Yeah. I feel like I've heard of that, but never actually looked into it.
All right, so I think before I ask you guys, is there anything about this that we've missed that we didn't talk about? That
one other, I was trying to think if there was any other characters, you know, major or minor that were worth bringing up. I always liked both the glove and Max, the sidekick. I love Max. I adore him as a character. He's got some great one-liners and. I just find him a very humorous character.
Yes, your blueness. Yeah, I forgot about Max. And Glove is, I didn't mention Glove because Glove has no dialogue.
Right.
But Glove is clearly a character. It's not,
yes.
He's not just in the background. I mean, Glove is playing a part. And Glove was, you know, to a small kid, I could see where Glove could be scary.
Yeah, yeah. He's got that, when he laughs, he's got that, you know, that weird reverberate. Yeah. Yeah.
I love that it was the biggest threat, but then they also, didn't they at one point in time say you can't have a glove without love? Wasn't that, but it actually was, Glove was like the biggest threat very early on in the film and kind of all the way through. Yeah. So it's funny how that came back around later. I thought that was kind of a clever little thing they did.
Okay, so now we're ready to rate. Scott, I'm going to throw it to you first.
Yeah, this is Jaws for me. I absolutely love this movie. You know that I have my personal criteria for these things. So for me, it usually comes down to three things. It comes down to the score. I love the score for this. I think it's fantastic. I listen to it quite often, usually late at night when I'm reading and I'm trying to fall asleep. It just makes a really great listen in that regard. But I think it's a wonderful score on its own. Quotability. This is an eminently quotable movie, and I quote this movie like crazy. This is probably the movie I quote the most, honestly. And it has my second favorite movie quote of all time, which is where they're trying to shatter or figure out a way to break the globe that's holding Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. And one of them says that they can't break it, that it's Beatle-proof. And John Lennon just says, "Nothing is Beatle-proof." And I just love the way he says it. That's a great line. Nothing is Beatle-proof. And I think this movie illustrates that. I know people that adore this movie because it was shown to them when they were children that don't particularly care for the Beatles, but they love this movie. And I love that about it, that it has that transcendent power, because it's just a really wonderful, charming movie. And then, of course, is both rewatchability, but also, like, if you're flipping channels and you catch it, are you going to stick with it and watch it? Yep, absolutely. If this is playing somewhere and I chance across it, well, that's it. I'm sucked in. I'm there. So yeah, it is definitely Jaws for me.
Hogan, what do you say?
I will agree 100%. You know, this being a movie that I grew up with and still love to this day, and again, rewatching it recently, I've grown to love even more, especially now that I can actually understand for the most part what they're actually saying. I think is a big thing. But yeah, the quotability. And I think in all regards, it's a movie that shouldn't even work, but does tremendously. You know, most of the songs that they put together for the entire album and for the movie were the scraps, pretty much. Hey Bulldog was pretty much a last minute song. I believe Nowhere Man was a last minute song or something to that regard. So in all regards, like, it shouldn't work, but it absolutely does.
Yeah, that's a good point, because yeah, if you listen to just the A side, and I think they eventually redid the album to include all the songs, because not all the songs were on the original album, as I recall. But if you listen to the album and just listen to the Beatles songs, it's a very eclectic mix. It doesn't have a distinct sound like most of the other Beatles albums had a certain rhythm, if you know what I mean, a certain, I don't want to say message, but you know what I mean.
Well, the Beatles kind of originated the, what they call AOR, album oriented rock, where it's
right.
It's the whole album kind of has a feel to it. It's not, you know, not just isolated songs. That was kind of their thing. And then other people kind of build on it. That's one of the genius things that they did.
Right.
But you're right. This one is just let's pick and choose.
Yep.
And by the way, I mentioned earlier, I mentioned, where's it? Only a Northern Song and what was the other one? Hey Bulldog. But there's also It's All Too Much, which was not previously on
love that record. Song. Yeah. It's funny because I remember as a kid thinking how odd it was that there was a song that was on the album that wasn't in the movie, and that was Hey Bulldog. But again, that was because it was in the movie everywhere but the US.
So again, like, the entire movie is just kind of a big mishmash. When it comes to the album, you got, you know, the sort of harder rock, I guess, with Hey Bulldog, whatever you'd want to class that as. You got psychedelic with what is it? All Too Much.
Lucy in the Sky. Mm-hmm.
Definitely Lucy in the Sky. I forgot about that one. Yeah. So it's the art style as well. You know, you describe it as, what was it? Monty Python with the still, like, photo. It's weird in its own way, at least to me. So you got that. And I wrote down that it almost, maybe it's just me, almost has a look of like Schoolhouse Rock, with its like really simplistic art style, but has like a cutesy art style. And I think that's what a lot of the movie has in a weird way at times, is just a cutesy look to it.
Well, that's one thing I noticed a lot more this time watching it, you know, purposely with a critical eye, is that, again, you know, it is very Fantasia-like in the aspect of it's not one animated style. You know, when they're doing Eleanor Rigby, it's very much Monty Python-esque. What's his name? Terry Gilliam. It's very Terry Gilliam-esque. When they're doing Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, I actually didn't used to like that sequence because it's heavily rotoscoped. And there's a sequence when the girl's riding the horse where it literally looks like somebody just like scribbled outside the lines with a crayon, if you know what I mean. Yeah. I watched that now and I think it's beautiful and I see what they were going for. But as a kid, I was like, wow, that's really sloppy. But it was experimenting with different animation styles for the different sequences. And that's pretty cool because that goes back to Fantasia. That's really neat.
I think for that song in particular, it might almost be intentional, because wasn't that song an inspiration from John's daughter?
John's son. Yeah. John's son. From
like a drawing that he had done.
Julian. It looks like that. It looks like a child that was handed, you know, a coloring book and just kind of scribbled on it.
That's a brilliant observation. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Cause that is the origin of that song.
I think to me a lot, and I can understand why, but a lot of people will look at this from an adult perspective and be like, oh, it's just a big acid trip or whatever. But I think it's kind of better to look at it from a child's point of view, and it's just a big imagination dream, you know?
Right.
Like if me as a kid were to dream this all up and then explain it to somebody, this is probably what it would look like to them.
Oh yeah.
That's a great thought. I like that. Sean, how do you rate this?
So it's interesting. When I watched it the first time, as I told you before, I was thinking to myself, I'm going to be a Jaws 3 on this one. halfway through, I'm like, what am I watching? Where is it going? To Scott's point, when the Fantasia part clicked for me, I'm like, oh, wait a minute. I think I like this. And I started going through the rest of the film and then rewatched it again. And watching it, like, once I understood what I was watching, for lack of a better way to say it, it quickly became Jaws for me, because I really started admiring the ambition of it. Then when you see the backstory of it, like the Beatles were like trying to get their third film done in their contract, and they're like, let's do an animated film. And to Logan's point, there kind of isn't this like flow that like was intended to be there with the songs and everything. It the way that they brilliantly turned this into like this story that works was something that it's an artistic joy. I love animation, and I think the Fantasia piece, when you get into experimentation that Fantasia was, that connection really works, because this is experimentation. This is art. And that's where I think this film truly works, is that it is an artistic masterpiece in what it's doing with animation and what it's doing with film, and also what it did musically all the way through. That was the part where when I finally got that, and I was not looking for Hard Day's Night and Help, and I got that out of the way, this easily became a Jaws for me. But I admit, I didn't start out that way. I had a journey to get there. But I'm glad I went on that journey.
I'm going to probably be the harshest of our crew, and I'm still going to give it a Jaws, but I'm going to start off with that. But I'm still going to be the harshest, I think, because I think it crystallized a little bit for me. I wasn't sure whether I was going to go Jaws or Jaws 2, frankly. And I think Logan hit it right on the head when he said it shouldn't have worked, but it did. I think that's the feeling that I have with this thing. And I am going to give it a Jaws, but I am going to give it the point that you have to watch this with an open mind. And I think, okay. Sean, I think you crystallized that a little bit, because when you first went, you had an expectation of what it was. So it's not that you're not open-minded, but I think you were a little disappointed that it wasn't meeting the expectation of what you thought until you started to just kind of sit back and say, let me let this movie take me where it wants to take me. And I think you need to do that with this movie in order for it to be a Jaws. So if you're going to be kind of harsh on it, if you're going to say, well, you know, it needs to all totally make sense and it needs to be, you know, images that I can totally get, then maybe this isn't for you.
Right.
And that's the reason, that is really the reason why I was on the fence as to whether or not I should give it a Jaws. But I think for what it was trying to do, I think it succeeded exceedingly well. I think the music and the score are wonderful. I think, as Scott said, that there are a lot of quotable things in this. I think the voice acting is well above average. And I think it's just, you know, as I said, there's a comfort food aspect to it where you could just put this on and let it go. And you know, like Scott said, even if you don't get where the story's going, you could just join right back in again. It's all fine. So there's things about this where it just succeeds on so many levels. And if you happen to dabble in mind altering drugs, it probably doesn't hurt.
Right.
not that I'm saying anybody should do that, but you know, really just, you know, fun on so many levels. I think that's what it comes down to. So thanks, guys, for coming on and doing this with us. This was fun, and it was fun to revisit the movie after I hadn't seen it in a couple of years.
Thank you very much for having us. I enjoyed that. I think you did too, right?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
Thank you, everybody, who's listening. And, you know, let us know what you think. I'm really curious. I would love, especially, you know, a lot of people join the Facebook page. I assume you're listening to episodes, and every once in a while somebody comes out and says what they think. Excuse me. But I would really love to hear from more of you. You know, give us your thoughts. Tell us where you agree with us, where you don't agree with us, and go on to Apple Music or iTunes or whatever they call it nowadays and give us some reviews. Give us some 5 stars. Come on. We're good. But we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
I must complete my bust. 2 novels, finish my blueprints, begin my begin.
Hey, Jeremy, must you always talk in rhyme?
If I spoke prose, you'd all find out I don't know what I talk about. Ad hoc, ad loc, and quid pro quo. So little time, so much to know.
Hey, fellas, look.
The footnotes for my 19th book. This is my standard procedure for doing it, and while I compose it, I'm also reviewing it.
A boob for all seasons.
How can he lose?
Well, your notice is good.
It's my policy never to read my reviews.
There must be a word for what he is.